Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. Now, notice what's going on here. The topic of marital intimacy that came up, I don't know, a week ago, it just continues to come back to the fore again because many people are very interested in this. I mean, a lot of you are. And that makes sense because a lot of you are married. Some of you are older. And so this question, I mean, it's going to be a pertinent question for, I think, for most people well into old age. And so I'm returning to the topic yet again because it's important and because so many of you are reaching out with really good questions, kind of looking at this from different angles. So it's for that reason that I revisit the topic. It's not a topic I really ever talk about, but for some reason, it just really struck a chord with you. And that's good because I want the show to be meaningful to you and your life and what's going on. And this is one of those things for married people anyway. So I have another email that came in. And I'm going to revisit the topic for that reason, because there are different angles you can look at this from. So again, one more time, not appropriate for children. That little girl who just called me 10 minutes ago, she should not be listening to this. So mom, if you still have the radio on, you let her go in the other room and play with her Play-Doh. It's not an appropriate topic for children, and even not really an appropriate topic for younger teenagers. So fair warning, parents, ready, steady, go. So this email comes in from Sharon, and she's listening on the Relevant Radio app. And she says, "Hi, Patrick. I know you've touched on this a number of times over the past few days, but I feel that the matter was approached assuming that both spouses are practicing Catholics. My situation is much different in that I am a practicing Catholic and take my faith seriously. My husband grew up Catholic but has since stopped believing and, as such, does not hold my same beliefs. When it comes to marital intimacy, I really struggle with what is sinful. I am completely open to life, but he is not. I want to completely follow church teaching, but I am nearly always placed in a position where I cannot, and I know that the acts are sinful. At the same time, as a married woman, I know I also cannot deny the act to my husband. I dread the act because I feel I am just adding on to sin for both me and my husband. What is sinful for me if my husband is just not at the same place as me spiritually and thinks my beliefs are just ridiculous?" It's very difficult, she says. Understandably so. So here is the way the church approaches this topic for you, in particular as a wife. You're right that in marriage, when you make that public marriage contract, and you express your consent publicly, you are giving conjugal rights to your husband, and he is giving conjugal rights to you. And so that means that it's not obviously an absolute right. It's not an unrestricted right. It doesn't mean that at any time or under any circumstances that the husband or the wife can demand what is traditionally referred to as the marriage debt. Even that word sometimes drives people crazy. So don't think of it as a debt, but We do, as married people, have an obligation to give to the other spouse this right that we freely consented to, each to the other, mutual self-giving, it's also called. We have this obligation when it is a just, when there is a just request for it. So again, I want to underscore, it's not unrestricted and it's not absolute. You don't have an absolute right at any time or in any way to demand this from your spouse, but you do have the right under just circumstances. And conversely, neither spouse has the right to withhold conjugal rights from the other spouse for no good reason. Now, if you just had a baby, well, that's a very good reason. You can say, absolutely not. My body needs to heal. That would be an unjust request on the part of the husband. But if the husband is not asking for this in a way that is, in any way out of the ordinary, and it just may not be what, one spouse feels like doing at that time, that's where you should accommodate each other. Not everybody is going to feel ready for that at any given moment. And this is where generosity comes in and being accommodating and loving to your spouse. In a way, it's a form of showing love. And we're not talking here about physical love, but it's a way of showing love by being generous with something that you might otherwise not really feel like doing. Okay, so I think enough said about that. But that's the foundation for the answer that I want to give you on this other issue, because in the Marriage Act, if you as the wife are seeking to be moral and do the right thing, and your husband insists on something that is immoral and not right, and you might want to read Genesis chapter 38, the story of Onan. I'm wondering if this might be part of what you're describing, kind of in this oblique way. If that is an example of what we're talking about here, what the church says is that you as the wife, you should remonstrate with your husband, meaning, this is wrong, don't do this, this is sinful, I don't want to do this, and I don't want you to do this. But if the husband insists on doing that you as the wife are not guilty of any sin. Yes, you're engaging in the marital act after a fashion, of course. It's not the natural way. It's not the normal way. But if that's an example of what you're kind of alluding to, he's committing a sin and you're not. And you can, in good conscience, enter into the act with your husband, even if you know that he has a tendency to commit a certain sin of that nature. You can still, with a clear conscience, engage in marital intimacy. And the church emphasizes that you yourself are not committing a sin. But it is expected that you, and from what you've told me in your letter here, you have told him, I don't want to do this. This is wrong. Okay. Now, let's say that it wasn't that sin, Genesis chapter 38, again, if you want to read more about that. Let's say it's not that sin. Or let's say that's one of the sins, but let's say there's another sin that is truly unnatural. And I'm thinking, going back to the Genesis, you may remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and how God destroyed these cities with fire and brimstone because of a particular sin that the men in these cities happened to be committing with impunity. Let's say it's that sin. That would be different. You would have to say no. Not going to do it. Not going to happen. And you are not obliged to provide marital intimacy if that's the form in which he wants to make use of it. And you should say no to him, because that's then going to that's going to lead you into participating in something that is, this is one of the sins, by the way, that cries out to heaven for vengeance, the Bible says. There's like five or six sins that cry out to heaven for vengeance. That happens to be one of them. So that's a little bit of a rule of thumb where it's permissible for you, but where you have to draw the line and say, let's say he wants to introduce something else, whatever that something else may be, you have the right, in fact, in some cases, even the duty to say, no, I will not participate in that. I will not do that. That's not going to happen. So that's my advice. Now, obviously, it's a difficult situation, and I'm so sorry to hear that your husband is disrespectful to you, and I'm sorry to hear that he's away from the faith. That's a very heavy cross for you to have to carry. And I'm hopeful that in time, he will come to his senses, and he will come back to a practice of his faith and get right with God and confess these sins and stop doing them. If he's doing those sins, I shudder to imagine what other sins may be going on, but that's between him and God. So hang in there, be faithful, be generous. It's a tough cross to carry, and ask God to help you, and ask God to help change your husband's mind and his heart. Those things do happen. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if there are married couples listening right now who are saying, yep, that's right, that used to happen, and we got back on track, thanks be to God. And thank you for the email. Again, an important topic. We have to handle it very delicately, though. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Weldon now in Capitola, California. Good morning. Hi, Weldon.
Good. Sorry about that. I'm not super tech savvy. I had to switch over to the phone. So okay. I have a question about Genesis. My wife is coming into the Catholic Church. She's got a long history of being a very faithful Protestant. And we learned that the story of Adam and Eve isn't to be taken literal. From what I understand, there's no dogma. It's not dogmatic, so she doesn't necessarily need to either believe it or not believe it. And I was just wondering, how does one who's got that thorough history reconcile that? And what is the other who's on creationism?
Yeah, I couldn't really hear the last thing that you just said because your phone cut out, but I heard the first part. So this is an error that was told to your wife. The church does indeed teach that Adam and Eve were real historical characters. They were real historical personages. So they're not mythical. This is not just a story. They're real people. And if you want something that it is magisterial, of course, you can look at the encyclical letter by Pope Pius XII. It's called Humani Generis. And it has to do with the human race and how the human race came into existence. So that particular topic he treats of. Now, he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about Adam and Eve per se, but here's what he does say about them, and this is in section 37. When, however, there is a question of another conjectural opinion, namely polygenism. Now, I'll pause there. Polygenism is the notion that there were many different Adams and Eveses, so to speak, and that God created a whole bunch of original human beings, and the population of humanity came from all these various different people. So he's referring to that theory. He says, that conjectural opinion, polygenism, the children of the church by no means enjoy such liberty to believe. For the faithful cannot embrace that opinion, which maintains that either after Adam there existed on this earth true men who did not take their origin through natural generation from him, as from the first parents of all, or that Adam represents a certain number of first parents. He says it is in no way apparent how such an opinion can be reconciled with what sources of revealed truth and the documents of the teaching authority of the church propose with regard to original sin, which proceeds from a sin actually committed by an individual Adam, A-D-A-M, and which, through generation, is passed on to all and is in everyone as his own. So when he says here Adam, of course, he's referring to Adam and Eve, but this is a magisterial, dogmatic teaching, really always has been, that Adam and Eve were two real people and the whole human race comes from these two original parents whom God created. So that is the answer to, that is the antidote rather to the error that your wife was told. Whoever told her that Adam and Eve are not real people or that it's just a story or anything like that, that person is completely wrong. So we are obliged to believe in a literal historical person named Adam. Well, he may not have been named Adam. That's the name that is given in Scripture. But that actual first couple, they are our original parents. The whole human race comes from them. And that's what the church teaches. So
because that makes a lot of sense, but the when it was being explained to us, and she's a, I'm asking because she asked this at our RCIA class yesterday, and they were making it seem like it wasn't symbolic, but it was figurative speech where it's open to interpretation. And she was like, well, if they weren't our original parents, how do you reconcile the two? And then where would original sin have come from? So, because I understand how there might be some figurative speech in the creation of the earth with it's describing the heavens or the sky as a dome. And I understand that you can't look at Genesis to explain anything that's necessarily scientific. But, yeah, I just wasn't sure how to help her. And I thought, you know, what better way than to call somebody who's a lot smarter than me to figure this out?
Well, I don't know about that. Just so happens I have some info there. Yeah, you're right. It is true that there are elements, certainly, of the book of Genesis, and in this case, let's talk about the creation account, that are not intended to be historical or scientific treatises. They don't. It's not intended in Genesis, say, 1 through 3, to describe how God did these things. It's there to describe, rather, that God did these things. So the terminology that's used there, for example, God doesn't need to rest. We're told that God rested on the seventh day, the Sabbath, after all of his exertions. Well, God doesn't exert himself. He doesn't expend any energy. He doesn't get tuckered out. He doesn't need to rest because as God in his nature, he can't become something other than he already is. He can't gain something that he doesn't already have. All of his perfections are without limit. This is how we talk about God as being infinite. So all of his perfections are without limit. He can never gain or become something that he doesn't already have or is. So for that reason, this would be a good example of how the Genesis account is using language to describe something that is not literal. God didn't need to rest. He didn't break a sweat. He created everything out of, he just willed it into existence, and there it is. So if we take that as a starting point, we can recognize that although Genesis 1 and 2 are telling us God did these things, it's not telling us in any literal way exactly how God did them, just that he did do them. But the subject of the whole thing of creation is, as far as human beings are concerned, that God created a first man. He did that. And that's real. That's historical. And the church has always believed that. And then, of course, the woman that was created as well for his helpmate and the whole human race came from them. So it's correct to understand that not everything, in fact, several things in Genesis 1 and 2 should not be understood in a strictly literal sense. But that does not extend to the creation of Adam and Eve. That is an actual real event. Here's something else. This is from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. This is in paragraph 359. St. Paul tells us that the human race takes its origin from two men, Adam and Christ. The first man, Adam, he says, became a living soul. The last Adam, a life-giving spirit. And that's referring to Jesus. The first Adam was made by the last Adam. Think about that. God, and Jesus is God, he made the first Adam, from whom he also received his soul to give him life. The second Adam, Jesus, stamped his image on the first Adam when he created him. That is why he took on himself the role in the name of the first Adam in order that he might not lose what he had made in his own image. The first Adam, the last Adam. The first had a beginning. The last knows no end. The last Adam, Jesus, is indeed the first, as he himself says, I am the first and the last. Now that right there, I mean, that's some deep theology. And that is taken from a sermon from St. Peter Chrysologus, one of the early church fathers. But as you go through the catechism, you will see that Adam as an historical person is referenced many, many times. He's in there a lot. So take paragraph 404, for example. How did the sin of Adam become the sin of all his descendants? The whole human race is in Adam as one body of one man. By this, the unity of the human race is such that all men are implicated in Adam's sin as we are all implicated in Christ's justice. Now, it goes on from there. But the point is that would be impossible if there was no actual Adam. If there was no first father and mother, the whole idea of original sin would be impossible. So the two are closely connected, as you know. I feel as though maybe now I'm over-explaining it, Wilden, but I hope that's helpful to you. And I look forward to talking again. Let's take a break, and I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Let me ask you. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. Yeah. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Yeah. Relevant Radio.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Suzuki just wrote me a note from Minneapolis, listening on our 1330 AM station. Subject, gay friend. I have a friend who is gay. In our conversation, he said that having sex with his partner, by the way, age inappropriate, fair warning, ready, steady, go, not age appropriate for children, that doing this with his partner is the same thing as a married couple who can't procreate, but can still, I'm going to clean up the email a little bit, can still engage in marital intimacy. How should I answer this? And is it a sin to have marital intimacy if you can't procreate with your partner? Another very important question. Let's unravel it. First of all, let's consider marriage. The husband and the wife are mutually complementary to each other, meaning not that they say nice things to each other, although that's nice when that happens, but physiologically, the husband and the wife complement each other such that the two reproductive systems together are they make it possible for procreation. Two men, impossible. Two women, impossible. Any other combination, impossible. So as Jesus says in Matthew chapter 19, have you not read that in the beginning God made them male and female? And this is why a man leaves his family and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And therefore, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So there, in just one sentence, Jesus gives us the paradigm, not only of marriage, but of human sexuality. Even the language, clinging to your spouse, even that language is redolent of marital intimacy. So he says it right there. He says, this is God's plan for humanity. And yes, you're right. Procreation, or maybe let me say it this way. Marriage is ordered toward procreation, and the primary end or purpose of marriage is procreation. It's not the only end or purpose of marriage, but that's the primary end. And so a close secondary end or purpose of marriage is the mutual love of the spouses and the deepening of their friendship and all of those wonderful things that are associated with intimacy and marriage. That is also a purpose and goal of marriage, but the first purpose is procreation. But this doesn't mean that marital intimacy must produce offspring. It may be God's plan for that couple that they will not have any children. And for them, very often, it's a terrible cross to have to carry, a painful cross. It may be, in other cases, that God's will for that marriage is that there be many children. Nancy and I have 11 children. That's God's will for us. So the key here, and this is how we can unravel this seeming discrepancy. There really is no discrepancy here, but the apparent discrepancy, it might appear as though, well, you know, if the couple is old now or old enough where there's no possibility of procreation because the wife is, you know, in menopause or after menopause, let's just say, that in no way at all is a barrier to that couple enjoying marital intimacy for this reason. As long as the act is accomplished in a way, and there is only one way, as you know, for the act to be accomplished such that the possibility of human life being transmitted is there. So as long as this is the way in which the act is taking place, that's all the church, that's really all that God requires. Maybe the woman is infertile. That's okay. Maybe the woman or the man or both are beyond the age where it would be possible for them to conceive a child. That's okay. Because they're making use of this good of marriage in a proper way. It's ordained by God. It is a gift for married people, and they are not only free to enjoy it, they're encouraged to enjoy it, however old they may be. If they're 110 years old, it's still proper for them to enjoy this if they can. Now, typically it's not possible, but if they could, they could. And this is important because the key to remembering all of this, or to understanding it rather, is that the act has to be open to the possibility of life. And I know I've said this like a billion times, but I think it's important for us to think about this. So for your marriage, and I don't mean you, Suzuki, I'll come back to you in a minute, but for your marriage, anything that happens within that context between husband and wife that is not possible for the possibility of human life to arise, the possibility of procreation, and you're doing anything, whatever it may be, that ultimately concludes where there's no possibility for the transmission of human life, that is a sin. And it's a serious sin because it's using this good gift that God has given you in a way that is contrary to its intended purpose. God is not saying you have to crank out as many kids as you possibly can for as long as you possibly can. God is not saying that. What God is saying is, trust me and make use of marital intimacy in the natural way so that if I choose to bless you with a child, I will bless you with a child. Be open to me. Trust me. Be open to life, as you hear many people say. That's the essence of it. So within that context, all the things that are preparatory and helpful that will help perfect the act, that's all fine as long as it in itself is not sinful, excluding those things. But any other things that a married couple might seek to do to help perfect the act, to complete in a natural way, that's fine. The church says, enjoy. It's like being Adam and Eve in the garden. The only thing Adam and Eve had to do in the garden was have fun and name animals. But once that was done, that's all really God wanted from them, was to enjoy these good gifts he had given them. So back to you, Suzuki. Now that we have a clear understanding of what God's intended paradigm is for human sexuality, you can see then the vast difference between two men who can't do any of that in any case, and how that has really, there's no connection whatsoever. There's no comparison, rather, whatsoever with a married couple enjoying marital intimacy, and yet because of age or physical disability, they can't procreate. They have a right to that. God does not expect that they have children. It's the natural thing. After a certain age, you can't have children, but they have a complete right to it. Two men do not have a right to that. It's a serious sin. Go back to Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where the sin gets its name, by the way. And it is one of those sins that cries out to heaven for vengeance. So I hope that's helpful. And really, it can only really be, I think, understandable or intelligible unless you first have an understanding of what marriage is and what marriage is intended for. And once we understand that, once that's clear, then you can see, well, that obviously is not good over there, and that over there, that's not good, and this permutation is not good. You can exclude very easily all the things. You can very quickly realize all these other things are impermissible and wrong, but this, under these circumstances, in this way, this is good. And I hope that helps. 888-914-9149. Let's go back to the phones. Linda in the Twin Cities, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was wondering,
you're welcome,
if a non-Catholic can go to adoration.
Oh, absolutely. Anybody can.
Wow.
You're speechless. Is that not the answer
it's
you were expecting?
Such a quick answer.
Yeah, I'm known for long answers.
Between...
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Is there a difference between going to adoration with the monstrous or going into the church with the tabernacle?
Well, there's really no difference in one sense, and that is that the Lord is just as present in the monstrance. And for those who don't know that term, monstrance, from the Latin word monstrare, which means to show, we call it a monstrance. It's an upright sacred vessel, kind of on a stand, often gold or gold-plated. Well, it wouldn't be solid gold, but it has a gold appearance to it. And in the center of what often looks like a sunburst is a glass pane behind which the host sits so that you can see it. That's why it's called a monstrance. So it's basically, it's showing you the Lord in the Holy Eucharist. That's where that word comes from. So he is just as present there as he is if he were in the tabernacle behind the door of the tabernacle. The difference is, in one case, you can see him. You see the host, but with the eyes of faith, you're beholding God himself under the appearance of bread. So in one sense, there is no difference whatsoever. But from a human standpoint and our need for things like to be able to touch things and see things and taste things, it's more helpful, you might say, for you to see him in the monstrance. But I'd like to return, if you don't mind, to the issue of non-Catholics going to adoration, because I suspect there might be a subtext there I'd like to address, if I may. And I'm wondering,
mm-hmm,
if you're thinking about how non-Catholics cannot receive communion, why is it okay for them to go to adoration? And the difference here is that Holy Communion is reserved for, as St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, for those who are worthy, and that means that you are not in the state of mortal sin. None of us is truly worthy to receive Jesus, let's face it. But to be prepared, spiritually speaking, to receive Jesus would mean to not be in the state of mortal sin. And also to be a Catholic, to believe what the Church teaches about the reality of the real presence here. So St. Paul warns people against receiving communion, either because of unworthiness or for failing to discern or recognize the body. And I could add a third reason there that St. Paul doesn't mention, but it certainly fits with what he says, and that is it's a form of perjury to go forward and say amen, which is I believe, yes, I believe, I affirm this, and to not be in communion with the Church, because it's like going into a courtroom and swearing on a stack of Bibles to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But it's not really true when you say amen, because you're not really in communion with the body of Christ, or at least with the Catholic Church specifically. And so when we celebrate the sacraments, when we receive the Holy Eucharist as an example, it has as part of it the dimension of swearing an oath. And that amen that comes out of your mouth, or if you're at the traditional Latin Mass and you don't say it out loud, you're saying it interiorly, it's literally swearing an oath before God and the Church that yes, you do believe, yes, you are in communion, etc., and you don't want to commit perjury. So that's why, those are the reasons why non-Catholics, or Catholics for that matter, who are in the state of mortal sin, should not receive Holy Communion. For a Catholic in that state, he should go to confession first and then receive. For a non-Catholic, become Catholic. Then the doors are wide open and you can receive Holy Communion. But that's different from going to adoration and being there and praying to the Lord. A non-Catholic, we would encourage them to go. We would encourage them to maybe make that step in the direction of eventually becoming Catholic so they can be truly united with Jesus. So non-Catholics are warmly welcome to Mass. Non-Catholics are warmly welcome to come to adoration or to pray the rosary or to do anything like that. Receiving Holy Communion is something, as I just explained, which is in a different category. But by no means would we say to a non-Catholic, you can't come to adoration because you're not a Catholic. It's for everybody.
Well, that's good to hear. She's comfortable with, she's been in the Catholic Church for occasions and going through a hard time right now. And I just wanted to make sure that it was something approachable for her. Is there also a special prayer that I could give her? She's out of state. Is there a special prayer I could give to her for
I
time.
Really like the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Yeah, maybe the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Here's something you can do, Linda. I would say text her a link. text it to her phone, the link to the Relevant Radio app. And I'll explain why. So if you go to relevantradio.com, you'll see there, and it's in the navigation bar, where it says listen. And there you'll see where it says get the app. So if you click that, that takes you to the page where you can download it either for Android or iPhone or even other forms. And text her that link and then say, if you get this app, it's free, put it on your phone, and not only can you listen to the programs, but you can also access the Divine Mercy Chaplet anytime that you want. It'll be right there on your phone. You can go in the upper right-hand corner, and you'll click the Bible that's got a cross on it. It says pray, and it has the devotions, and the devotions include the Divine Mercy Chaplet. So, and many other prayers as well. So you can help her in more than one way by recommending that, and she'll have the prayer always with her wherever she goes.
That's a great idea. I like that one.
Well, I try. I try, Linda. Thank you. I appreciate it. Why don't we take a break and we'll come right back. Don't forget, this is pretty much your last chance. I say pretty much because it's not entirely gone yet. This massive print run of my brand new book called Inquisition. It's a book of quizzes. It will entertain you. It'll educate you. You'll have fun with it and you'll learn a lot, believe me. No matter how advanced you may be, you'll learn something in this book. Kids love it. Teenagers love it. College students love it. You're going to love it. And it's free. As long as it lasts, and this is just about the last week to be able to get it. So get your free copy of Inquisition by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Do it now before they're all gone. I don't want you to be disappointed. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening. Let's go to Olivia now in Raleigh. Good morning, Olivia.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering, I know we're not allowed to do IVF, but what is the church's teaching on adopting the already frozen embryos?
Yeah, this is one of those things that is still an open discussion. It's really more of a debate than a discussion. And the church doesn't have a teaching per se on this issue, mm-hmm. but it's debated in bioethical circles. And I think the preponderance of people who are in this debate say no, that it's not permissible. In fact, if you want to read a lot of literature, I try to stay current with the literature. So I subscribe to the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly. And that's just a quarterly mm-hmm. journal, as the title suggests. And I've read a lot of what both sides have to say. And personally, I'm not persuaded that we should not practice embryo adoption. I'm persuaded that we should. And there are, you know, eminent minds, clergy and others, who would disagree with me. But having read the literature and pondered the arguments for and against it, I personally, and I'm open to being corrected if the church comes out later and says, okay, definitively now, no, you can't do that. The church hasn't done that. And the way I look at it is, what else can you do? Because here we have these little unborn human beings, boys and girls, little kids, you know, they're at the embryonic stage, but they're children. And they are on ice, what, indefinitely? We just leave them on ice indefinitely and allow them to die eventually? It's just an intolerable, it's a horrifying and intolerable situation. And so I think under the circumstances, since the only way for them to actually mature to the point where they can be born is to be inside a mother's body, even if it's not the biological mother, I don't see any other way around it. It seems like the only viable way is to practice embryo adoption. Now, I'm just giving you my own opinion, and that's all it is. So take it for what it's worth. You know, I'm just a guy with a radio, a guy with a microphone. But I do believe that is the right approach. Now, there will be others who will say, no, that's not, because you would be committing a sin, they say. I don't think it's true. But the woman would be committing a sin by having introduced into her body the offspring of another couple. And that would be immoral because it would be, in a certain kind of twisted way, entering into marital intimacy, even though there was nothing intimate about it if IVF was practiced. I just don't see that as a viable argument. I look at it more as a wet nurse who nurses the baby of another mother because that mother, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. can't nurse her baby, so another woman nurses her baby. I see it as something akin to that. It's more than that, but it's something like that. And that is there's nothing immoral about a wet nurse nourishing a baby that is not her own. This is a step beyond that,
a
big step beyond that. Yeah. So my advice, if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty, and I think it's worth it, it was worth it for me to do that, get in touch with the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Their website is ncbcenter.org, and order a copy of that issue of the journal. Just say there was an issue in the journal, and there actually it has appeared more than once, but one particular issue in the journal where there were articles written on both sides of this debate about embryo adoption. I'd like to order a copy of that journal, and that'll be fascinating reading for you.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I didn't mean to give you a homework assignment, but if you're interested, I think you'll find that to be eye-opening. 888-914-9149. How about Calvin now in St. Paul? Hello, Calvin.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call, and God bless. I think a couple, 3 weeks ago, you talked about touch on the sacrament of marriage. So my question is, let's say you have a female Catholic that's in good standing, marrying to a non-Catholic in the church. And I think you mentioned that the sacrament of marriage is actually through the marriage vow given to from the woman to the man and the man to the woman. Mm-hmm. And then I believe That's you also right. mentioned that if the woman is in good standing and the man is not, the marriage is valid. And so would that marriage allow them to have marital intimacy? And my second question is...
Let's pause there because you just gave me a lot there, Calvin. So we'll get to the second question in a minute.
Yep.
So if the woman is in good standing, I guess by that you mean that she's a practicing Catholic. You're saying she's married a man who is, what, is he baptized or is he unbaptized?
Is unbaptized.
Okay. So if he's unbaptized and the church gives her permission to marry him, this is what's called disparity of cult. And that's just a technical term that the canon lawyers use. It can indeed be a valid marriage, but it would not be sacramental, because the sacrament of holy matrimony requires that both parties be baptized, because they confer the sacrament upon each other. And if one party is not baptized, he not only cannot confer the sacrament, he can't receive the sacrament. So that marriage would be what we would call a natural marriage. It would be valid, all other things being equal. It would be valid, but it would not be sacramental. Now, if he were a Catholic or just a baptized Christian of any sort, then... all other things being equal, again, assuming that she had permission to do this from her bishop, then yes, that could, in that case, be a valid marriage that was also sacramental because both parties are baptized. But if one or the other party is not baptized, it can be valid, but not, it would not be sacramental. So, and then I left out the last part of your question, can they engage in marital intimacy? The answer is yes, in both scenarios. Because marital intimacy is a gift of God for married people, and they have a right to it. In fact, God encourages them to engage in marital intimacy, not the least reason, in fact, the most important, is so that there will be children. And that's how the human race stays in existence. So married couples are strongly encouraged and warmly welcomed to avail themselves of this good of marriage. But if it's an invalid marriage, and let's just, to make it easy, let's say that they know it's not a valid marriage because, let's say, he was married to someone before, he got divorced, she marries him, and she knows, I'm not supposed to be married to him because Jesus said, if a man divorces his wife and gets remarried, he commits adultery. So in that situation, her conscience should tell her, you should not, first of all, you shouldn't be with this guy right now. And in the meantime, if for some reason you can't change your status, you should not be having sexual intercourse. You should be living as brother and sister. in that sense.
Okay. And also, real quick, Patrick, so would they have received the grace of the sacrament of marriage then? No, right?
No, they would. I mean, keep in mind there are two scenarios here. So if one party is not baptized, then there is no sacrament. It's a valid marriage, all other things being equal. It's a valid marriage, but it's not sacramental. For both parties who are baptized, it is not only a valid marriage, it's also a sacramental marriage. But those are two distinct things.
Correct, yes. I'm sorry, Patrick. The first scenario where he is not a practicing Catholic or not baptized at all. So would they both receive the full grace of the sacramental of marriage?
No. No.
Okay.
No. Because there is no sacrament. In order to have the sacrament, you have to have both parties baptized because they confer the sacrament upon each other. The priest doesn't. They confer the sacrament. And if one is not baptized, he can't confer a sacrament and he can't receive a sacrament because baptism is the foundation of all the other sacraments. I'm glad I could clear that up, Calvin. Thank you. Let's go to Liz now in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, Patrick. I heard you talking about embryo adoption, and I just felt like I had to call in because, at least to my understanding, and I'm willing to be corrected, I believe the church has spoken on this in a document from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It's called Dignitas mm-hmm. Personae. Have you read that?
I haven't. I've heard of it, but and it was referenced in some of the articles in that journal that I was mentioning. But I'd be very happy to take it up and read it and see what it says.
Okay. It's my understanding that document says that embryo adoption is not licit for a variety of reasons, but it retains all the problems that... Okay, it retains all the problems that surrogacy has. And there's many aspects of IVF that you still participate in when doing an embryo adoption. And so it's not just, you know, IVF in general is unacceptable. There's the freezing of children, the thawing of children, the implantation process, each and every little part is immoral and unacceptable. And you do some of that with embryo adoption. So there's that as the problem.
Let me just read the pertinent section, which I brought up here. The proposal, and this is in section 19, the proposal that these embryos could be put at the disposal of infertile couples as a treatment for infertility is not ethically acceptable for the same reasons which make artificial heterologous procreation illicit, as well as any form of surrogate motherhood. This practice would lead also to other problems of a medical, psychological, and legal nature. It has also been proposed solely in order to allow human beings to be born who are otherwise condemned to destruction, that there would be a form of prenatal adoption. And that's more specifically what we're talking about. This proposal, praiseworthy with regard to the intention of respecting and defending human life, presents, however, various problems not dissimilar from those mentioned above. All things considered, it needs to be recognized that the thousands of abandoned embryos represent a situation of injustice, which in fact cannot be resolved. Therefore, John Paul II made an appeal to the conscience of the world scientific authorities, and in particular to the doctors, or two doctors, that the production of human embryos be halted, taking into account that there seems to be no morally licit solution regarding the human destiny of thousands and thousands of frozen embryos, which are and remain the subjects of essential rights and should therefore be protected by law as human persons. So that gets to the heart of what you're referring to. And I'm glad you brought this to my attention. I had seen excerpts of this document from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, but I have not actually read it in its entirety. So thank you for that. But nonetheless, I don't think the door is entirely closed here. Because if you read closely what it says here, it says there seems to be no morally licit solution. It doesn't foreclose absolutely on the possibility. And I guess maybe that's what I'm hanging my hope on. And that is, as time goes by, there may be a solution to this terrible dilemma. And that's something that I think, or at least I hope, is kind of a sliver of openness or a possibility that something, it may at some point be something that is not as negative as this certainly is. And you're right about that. So anyway, I'll have to leave it there only because I'm out of time now. But thank you, Liz. And thanks for the suggestion on that. So for those who are interested, this document that Liz just mentioned, it is called Dignitatis Personae, which means the dignity of the person. And it is available on the Vatican website. I have it right in front of me. It's from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Instruction, Dignitatis Personae, on certain bioethical questions. And this is one of the bioethical questions that it takes up in its discussion. So for those who are interested, you'll find it there. And I am out of time. So I guess a man has to know his limitations.
Man's got to know his limitations.
Yeah. You need some new tricks, Cyrus.
You're a legend in your own mind.
I'm hip to this.
I can say it. Well, isn't that special? Almost as well as you can.
All right. Well, thank you all. Appreciate it. Don't forget the brand new book. It is available for free, but you have to get it. And the only way to get it is to go to relevantradio.com/quiz. It is a collector's item. You can't get it in any bookstore. You can't order it on the internet. You can't get it from Amazon, but you can get it free from us by going to relevantradio.com/quiz. This is just about the end of the line because they're flying off the shelf so quickly, and I don't want you to miss out. It's free, and this is your last chance. It's just about over, so act now. Go on the Relevant Radio app and order it. All you have to do is tell us where to send it. No shipping, no handling. It's all free. But do it now before they're all gone. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.